You begin looking at it, and all of a sudden, we know the story. It's about what happened after Solomon died. What happened after Solomon died? The kingdom was divided. There's a northern kingdom, and there's a southern kingdom. The northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. And then all of a sudden, it gets confusing. I think it is the most confusing book to try to read because you get lost in it. And it took me a long time to figure out how to study 1 Kings. And the way I study 1 Kings is I only study one of the kingdoms at a time. Because as you read through this, you've got 19 kings in the northern kingdom. And the northern kingdom, you know, ends. Well, it doesn't end until you get over to 2 Kings. But you begin looking at it, and there are very few chapters devoted to those kings. You know what is said about all the northern kings? He did evil in the sight of the Lord. And what was we looked at, I think, the last time we taught? He ruled 7 days and he did evil in 7 days. You really got to work at it to do evil in 7 days. And for that to be the one thing God tells you about, you gives you names and everything, tells, you know, who was reigning down in the other kingdom. But when I've read 1 Kings, you go from the northern kingdom to the southern kingdom, back and forth. And frankly, it took me a long time to keep from getting lost. So what I do and what I've done as I've studied, and I would recommend this to every one of you, if you really want to get a grasp of it, is just take a piece of paper, you know, it's better, one of those legal pads, something like that, or one of those, not 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, but 8.5 by 14, turn it sideways. And then I just write, because Israel is a northern kingdom, I'd write kings of Israel. And then on the bottom half, I would write kings of Judah. And then I would, in some way, try to make a timeline, and you don't have to make it accurate. But you see, the southern kingdom lasts 100 years longer than the northern kingdom does. And so if you just draw a line to represent each of them, they're the same length, you're not going to see what this is all about. And so I've done it using a ruler and letting an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch represent, you know, 10 or 15 years or whatever you want to make it. And then you can get a real picture of it. But it's not all that difficult to do it. Because in the southern kingdom, you've got Asa and Jehoshaphat. And they rule, what was it? I think James was here last week. Was it 72 years or something like that? That is in the beginning of that southern kingdom, all of those first three or four kings. And up in the north, there's 3 years, there are 2 years, there are 12 years, there are 7 days. And so I got lost. And then what I do is to make a notation about something about that king. Now you'll have a whole lot more notations to make about the southern kings, because they're names that you'll recognize. But as you look at 1 Kings, what's it all about? Well, you go through the first 16 chapters, and it was he reigned so and so, and he began to reign in the such and such year of the reign of Asa, and he reigned 12 years, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. Next verse. And his son reigned, or, you know, he killed someone, there was an insurrection, he killed all of that family, and so and so became king, and he began to reign. So in the umpteenth year of the king of Asa, and so you've got Asa and Jehoshaphat, you've got a long period of time, if you do it by inches or something like that to get a grasp of it, and you'll see it if you'll do that on a piece of paper. Because you've got 19 kings in the northern kingdom and 19 kings in the southern kingdom. And so there's a quick turnover of kings in the northern kingdom. And when you get over to the southern kingdom, you get over to Manasseh, and he's a southern king. He reigns 55 years. So you've got Asa and Jehoshaphat, and you've got Manasseh. And so you've got a good 100 years with three names there. And if you're just trying to read it chronologically, I couldn't do it. I know what I was doing, but I'd forget, oh, yeah, and then I'd get lost. And so doing that, laying that out horizontally, really, really helped me understand it. So if you're going to do a study of 1 Kings, I think it's the best way to do it. And then you'll have some idea about it. But guess what? 1 Kings and 2 Kings is not primarily about the kings. That may shock you. Look in 1 Kings chapter 17. In 1 Kings chapter 17, you've got the introduction of a character, and you know this character. Now, you've been reading about he reigned this long and he reigned that long and began to reign in such and such a year, and you keep flipping back and forth. And you read those first 16 chapters, and I will assure you, if you're not careful, you're going to be confused. But all of a sudden, whenever you get to 1 Kings chapter 17, you recognize the name of that man? Guess when he dies? All the way through 1 Kings, all the way to the end of 1 Kings, he's still alive. You've got to get over to 2 Kings, and you've got his death, early chapters of 2 Kings. What's 1 Kings all about? I think it's about Elijah. And God spends, how many chapters in 1 Kings? He spends, all of 1 Kings telling us about Elijah and his interaction with the kings. And that's why they're over here in this part. Now, whenever Elijah dies, who takes his place? Did I give the answer away?
Yeah, Elisha.
You know when Elisha dies? 13 chapters into 2 Kings. What's 1 Kings all about? Elijah. What is 2 Kings about?
Elisha.
Now, wait, why they name it Kings? Because that's who they dealt with. And so they're there and they're dealing. And if we were had time to give a detailed look at that, you'd see how their interface sometimes in anointing kings anointing kings, etc., even of foreign kingdoms. Are you aware that Elijah went and anointed a king of the Syrians? Well, yeah, it's in the book of Kings, but it's all about Elijah. And so what I want us to do is to focus on Elijah tonight the best that we can and cover his life. What do you know about him? Where's he born? He's mentioned there in 1 Kings chapter 17. Is he mentioned before that anywhere in the Bible? Answer's no. All of a sudden you're in 1 Kings. And whenever you get to 1 Kings, Ahab is ruling in the northern kingdom, and now all of a sudden, Elijah the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab. Where'd he come from? Just all of a sudden, he's there. We know about the origin of some of the other prophets and their background. But all of a sudden, if you're reading this and you're not acquainted with what we're talking about, you know Elijah. I hope you know that name. I hope you know Elijah was a prophet of God. But all of a sudden, he pops up. I thought we were reading about the kings. Well, brace yourself. You're going to read about some of the kings, but you're going to read about Elijah. And that's what 1 Kings is all about. What's 2 Kings all about? Elisha. And if you, I'm trying to, you know, our intent is to give an overview of the book. But if you don't get that concept, you won't recognize how he dominates this. Now, we know story after story about Elijah. He was replaced by Elisha. And Elisha says, whenever Elijah says, before I leave, before I'm taken away, what can I give to you? And he said, I want a double portion of your spirit. Now that's over in 2 Kings, and we're not going to spend time looking at Elisha, but I say to this that Elijah performed 7 miracles. That's an amazing number. How many miracles did Isaiah perform? Jeremiah? Ezekiel? Isn't that amazing? Prophets don't do miracles. I mean, they do, you understand. But when we think about the prophets and all of a sudden, here's this guy that just pops up and he's performed one miracle after another, after another, after another, after another. Now, you remember what Elisha asked for? How many miracles of Elisha are recorded? You want to guess? 7 and then 14. Give me a double portion of your spirit. And so what you have here is 21 miracles. Guess where they performed them? In the northern kingdom. Why is this? God is trying to get these guys, the northern kingdom, to straighten up their lives. And every king they have takes them further and further away from God. There's not a good king in the entirety of it. Whenever Solomon dies and Jeroboam becomes that first king of that northern kingdom, just start it down, start it down, start it down, and it keeps going until they're taken captive and scattered by the enemies that scattered them. That's what's going to happen to them. And then all of a sudden, there are these prophets. How many prophets are there in abundance like that? Well, yeah, Moses was a prophet, yes, but Moses had a whole lot of other stuff that he took care of too. I would not be surprised at all if Elijah and Elisha, by their miracles, authenticate the rest of the Old Testament prophets. If I just step back and look at this book, why on earth do we have all of this? Do you know, this is wrong, and I don't mean disrespectful, but you can know that northern kingdom if you knew almost nothing about Elijah and Elisha. This is not a chronology of the northern kingdom. It's not what it is. And so whenever you say there are 19 kings in the northern kingdom, it's a chronology. What's it about? It's about Elijah trying to deal with evil. Now, he's not on the scene that long. In fact, he's on the scene about as long as Ahab is on the throne. That's interesting. And so the whole time, you know, the last half of 2 Kings, of 1 Kings, is about Elijah, but it's always Ahab and Elijah. It's always Ahab and Elijah, Ahab and Elijah. And finally, you get over near the end of the book, and Ahab takes Naboth's vineyard. That's an interesting story, and Fran and Cain are both here. I bet you guys have told many of the stories about Elijah back when you're doing all that puppet work and everything. They're just some of the most exciting miracles there are in the Bible. I mean, it's everything that's about it. And every one of them's unique. But where's Elijah come from? Now, what happened to him when he died?
He was taken up.
He didn't die. Elijah is one of the two men in the Old Testament who did not die because God took them up. Now, when we get to study 2 Kings, we'll talk about whenever the tornado sucked Elijah up into heaven, up toward heaven anyway. That's in 2 Kings. That's not our purpose other than just to remind you of it. Elisha did 14 miracles. And I don't know if in the list of 14 you would include what happened when Elisha died. They buried him, and the very next verse, it's in 2 Kings 13, the very next verse after Elisha dies and they buried him in a grave, there's some people carrying somebody out to bury them. They're going to take them out to bury them. And some of the enemy nation, some of the enemies come by, robbers come by to attack these Jews. And so they put the body of the dead man in Elisha's grave. Do you know the story? And he came alive. That's pretty remarkable. And every one of these 21 miracles is remarkable. You remember the story of Elisha where a guy lost the metal part of his axe and his axe head went into the water. You know what Elisha did? He caused that heavy axe head to float in the water. That's a different kind of miracle. And these 21 miracles, almost every one of them is fascinating. Okay, let's talk about it. Ahab jumps into the pictures. I know nothing about him. You know nothing about him. He's a Tishbite. That's the village he's from. And all of a sudden he's here, and the Bible doesn't give us, any background about him. I just found that absolutely amazing. All we hear reading the chronology of the king, and all of a sudden says, and Elijah the Tishbite goes to Ahab. And he says to him, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years until I ask that there be rain. And the roar of the Lord came to him, saying, run for your life. You'd better hide out, because you're talking about confrontation and enemies. Ahab, right now at this very point, maybe prior to this point, no indication of it, but prior to this point, now from here on, they're this way. And Ahab is doing everything he can to kill Elijah. And so the Lord says, you better get away from this. You better leave this place. And let me pause long enough to mention that Elijah, because he's in 1 Kings so often, but he's mentioned in the New Testament. He's mentioned in other books. And if we have time, we'll try to look at some of those. But the name Elijah is found 100 times in the Bible. How many times is John the Baptist mentioned? I doubt it'd be 100. You think about that. But here's Elijah, and he's mentioned 100 times. Why? Because now the spotlight that has been, he was king this long, he's king this long, he was this king this long, and the latter part of chapter 16, and Ahab gets on the throne. What does he do? Well, he introduces pagan gods up in the end of that northern kingdom. He does that type of thing. Why did he do that? Because of Mrs. Ahab. You remember her name? Ahab and? You said it. Jezebel. Ahab and Jezebel. And so now the confrontation is more Elijah and Jezebel than it is Elijah and Ahab. Now, I'm not, is as much Ahab and Jezebel, or pardon me, is Elijah and Jezebel as it is Elijah and King Ahab, because she's right in the forefront of it all. He says, it's not going to rain. Now, he prays, and it does not rain. How long does he pray that it will not rain? 3.5 years. That's an interesting number. 3.5 years is in the book of Revelation, by the way. And I find that interesting in and of itself. That's another, we're not chasing that one. I'd like to, but that's not where we're headed. But you've got some real rather significant things. Where on earth, if there's going to be a famine, where are you going to find food? You know what the Lord tells Elijah to do? Go out to the brook. There's your water. Where does this food come from? The ravens. How often did they bring him food? Now, Chuck, I don't know about you. How much food can one little raven bring to you? You understand? You know, have you ever thought about the ravens coming and bringing him food? And I even wonder what kind of food they brought him. I mean, this is not there. Just get in line behind me. I've got so many questions to ask some of these characters when we get to heaven, But I'd like to. And all you do is you keep reading about that. Is that a miracle? Yeah. I mean, it's I guess you would say this is above nature for bird to bring food and bring enough food for him to have 2 meals a day. And he's eating while everybody else has no crops. And then all of a sudden, the brook dries up. And so when the brook dries up, look in verse 8 and 9. The word of the Lord came to him saying, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. For I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. And so now then, he goes up, and we don't know exactly how long he has spent beside that brook, but when that dries up, the Lord says, I'll take care of you. And so he tells, go up to Zarephath, not a Jewish city. Sometimes we think about God, forget about the Gentiles. There's a widow up there, and I've commanded her to provide food for you. And so he gets up there and he sees this woman, and she's out gathering some wood. Why? Because she's got a vessel of oil and one enough meal, enough flour meal to make one more dinner or lunch or whatever. And that's it. And she and her son are going to eat it, and then they're going to starve to death. Why? Because the famine is up in that northern country also. You know what Elijah tells her to do? Go make me a cake first. You want to become this woman? You want to emotionally become this woman? She is absolutely desperate. I mean, she has been pouring out that oil, and it's running out, and using as little flour as possible. And that's it. I've got enough to feed me and my son. And you want me to make you a cake? And he says, go. And so she goes and makes him a cake. And whenever she begins to pour that oil out, he's told her that the Lord will do some wonderful things on the earth. And it said in verse 16, the bin of flour was not used up, nor did the jar of oil run dry, according to the word of the Lord. Widow. Think of how helpless a widow was. And yet she gave and kept Elijah alive. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Now, the New Testament talks about there were many widows. Jesus talks about this very incident in Luke chapter 4. He talks about this very incident to the Jews, says, you're not just the only people God's concerned about. Let me remind you of a widow in the Old Testament. There were many widows in Judea at that time. But Elijah was not sent to a Jewish widow. He was sent to a woman up in that land who had great faith in whatever God told her to do. Now, Ahab is desperate. Ahab's doing all right. He's got the king. He's got a lot to eat because he's the king. And so the next miracle there is here, and we're not going to have time to look at all of this. Look in chapter 18. Came to pass, after many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go see Ahab, and I will send rain. So Ahab went to present himself to Ahab. There was a severe famine in Samaria, and Ahab had called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Obadiah feared the Lord. Now, this is not the guy who wrote the book of Obadiah. It's another Obadiah. Chronologically, it doesn't fit in the right place. That's why we know it's another one. That while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets, put 50 in one cave, and probably 50 another, and had fed them with bread and water. Here's Obadiah. And he's in charge of dispensing the food. And Jezebel is trying to kill all the prophets. And that, in fact, that's about what she's done. There are 400 prophets that are at her table, at the table of Ahab and Jezebel. That's a lot of food. So King Ahab and Obadiah go out, and the charge given to them in verse 5, go into the land, to all the springs of water, to all the brooks, Perhaps we may find grass to keep the horses and the mules alive so we will not have to kill the livestock. I mean, everybody else is suffering. Not Ahab, not Jezebel. They're taken care of. I mean, they're taking care of themselves. And so while Ahab's going one way and Obadiah's going another way, verse 6, they divided the land. Obadiah was on his way and Elijah met him and he recognized him and fell on his face. Is that you, Elijah, my Lord? And he answered and said, it is I. Go tell your master Elijah's here. And he says, oh no. If I go tell my master that instead of finding some grass, I found Elijah. When you come back, you won't be here. That'll be the end of my life. He's reluctant to do it. It's a great story. Here's a man in a pagan palace keeping alive the prophets of God in a time of famine. The Lord not only fed Elijah the prophet, he fed 100 prophets in that northern kingdom, which in and of itself is a remarkable number, as pagan as that land was. But they were there. And so she's trying to massacre all of those. And he says, no, you tell him to come. But look how he describes it. He says in verse 9, have I not sinned that you're delivering your servant into the hands of Ahab? As the Lord your God lives, there's no nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to find you. What? We've been 3 years. What caused this famine? This guy Ahab. Pardon me. This guy Elijah, because of Ahab's action. Elijah caused this famine. We're going to kill this man. And so what's Ahab been doing? He's not only looked all over the northern kingdom trying to find him, he can't find him. He sent messengers to the nations around them. In fact, Obadiah said to every one of the nations, if Elijah's there, you let me know. You know, I'm ready to bring judgment against Elijah. And they can't find him. Where is he? In the house of a widow in a town called Zarephath, which is up in Sidon, Tyre and Sidon, the Phoenician cities. And they can't find him. And so whenever King Ahab comes, he looks to Elijah, and I love this story whenever he says, here's that troubler of Israel. Troublemaker, I have been looking for you. And Ahab says, I am not the troublemaker. You need to file this story away. Because there will be times in your life in which you try to make people change their lives. There'll be times in your life in which you want to talk to your family. You want to try to convert them. And you know how they feel towards you. There he is. There she is. If she or he would just shut up, there'll be a whole lot more peace in this family. I love what Elijah said. Not my problem. The reason there's a famine is because the Lord said, if you're not faithful to me, I'll shut the heavens. And that's exactly what the Lord has done. I am not the troublemaker. And you need to keep that in mind. That will encourage you to stand up for what's right. And I love it. And I really appreciate it when I know there are those who stand up for that which is right in spite of the family. And so he says, okay, let's have a contest. Let's go up to Mount Carmel and you get the prophets of Baal, and I will come up there, and we'll meet up there at Mount Carmel, and we'll have a contest to show which God is God. And so they get up to this mountain, and the prophets of Baal build an altar. And they start crying out to Baal to send down fire. That's the contest. You ask Baal to send down fire, I'll ask God to send down fire. I'll ask Jehovah God. And it is so interesting, the courage Ahab has. They begin to dance around and, you know, around that place up there, begging Baal to send down fire. They literally take knives and begin to cut themselves to try to think, well, this will just show how much we want Baal to do this very thing. You know what Elijah says? Maybe he's on vacation. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe you need to wake him up. Maybe he's deaf. You know how old God would be at this time? And as you get old, don't you lose your hearing? Maybe you're just not shouting loud enough. So it's time for the evening sacrifice. Elijah builds an altar and pours water on it. Not just one time, but I believe it's four different times. There are three measures of water that's poured on it, and the altar is soaking wet. There's a trench dug around it, and that trench is filled with water. And Elijah calls on God, and fire comes down and consumes the sacrifice, the wood, obviously, consumes the altar and consumes the water. Who's God? These are different kinds of miracles. It's not Jesus healing the sick. God is giving authentication to Elijah, and evidently through him to authenticate all the other prophets that are about to come. Now, we don't have time to talk about this. Elijah, when we study 2 Kings, will go up in a whirlwind. I think a whirlwind's a tornado. It's a twirling wind that takes Elijah away. I want you to look at the last verse of the Old Testament. I want you to see the importance of Elijah. Now, what's the time gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament? God had prophets, kept having prophets, sending prophets. In fact, all of the last 17 books of the Old Testament are books written by the prophets. And all of these come along after Elijah and Elisha. That's why evidently Elijah and Elisha are there to authenticate them. They don't have to do miracles. Why? The office has already been authenticated by Elijah and Elisha and what God does in 21 of the most remarkable miracles you'd ever read about. I would encourage you, if it's been a while since you've read the last few chapters of 1 Kings, you ought to do it. Every one of these miracles will just absolutely astound you what's happening. Now, when you get to the last book, the Lord's not going to say anything for 400 years. And here is the last thing that he says. Remember the law of Moses, Malachi chapter 4, verse 4, my servant, which I commanded you at Horeb, Mount Sinai. Still there. Jots and tittles are still there. Remember what I commanded you with the statutes and judgments. Behold, look, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of Jehovah. Jehovah's coming. Isn't that the message of the Old Testament? Someday someone is coming, and the Lord says, and it's the last thing he says, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet, and then the day of the Lord is going to come. What's Elijah the prophet going to do? When he comes, he's going to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children. That's an amazing thing. Neglectful fathers will start paying attention to their children. And the hearts of the children to their fathers. And look at the last word of the Old Testament. And if I don't send you Elijah, guess what I am going to send you? The last word of the Old Testament is a curse. And that's the last thing God said. Who's this Elijah? It's John the Baptist. Elijah was out into the wilderness. Guess how he dressed? Camel's hair. What did John the Baptist wear? Camel's hair. He's not a city prophet. Elisha is in the city. He's got his suit and tie, you understand. Elijah is out in the wilderness. And he's always in the wilderness. You don't read about him in a city at all. I mean, you rarely read about him being, you know, visible, doing preaching in the city. Elisha's in the cities, different kind of work, but doing different miracles. And if I don't send you Elijah the prophet, that's the end of it. Because when Elijah the prophet comes, he will turn the hearts of the fathers unto their children and the hearts of the children unto their fathers. Look in the book of Luke, the announcement to Zechariah. 400 years, and now we get now we've got the announcement to the father of John the Baptist, and he says, "This is the one." I think it's in verse 17. He said, "He shall turn many of the children of Israel," Luke chapter 1, verse 16, "to the Lord." Verse 15, "He will be great in the sight of the Lord, shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will be filled with the Spirit, either from, and he will go before him," the Messiah, "in the spirit and the power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just." That's the very last thing God said. And now here is Zechariah. You think the Jews didn't know this last verse of the Old Testament? Isn't that amazing? The last verse of the Old Testament has curse. You know what the closing verses of Revelation says? Grace. That's it. We've got one more week. Thank you very much.